All right, Lisa, you're in charge. This is the Lisa Show. Welcome, everyone, to the Lisa Show. With your host.
Oh, yeah, I have to do all that stuff. Okay, right.
Do it as well as Chris did it.
I don't think I did it well. I think I just mumbled through it. Like, oh, right, I'm supposed to do this now.
Official start. Let's see. I've never done this before, Phil, I don't think. Welcome, everyone, listeners, to another episode of Vertical Playpen. I am thrilled to be guest hosting this week's episode. My name is Lisa Hunt. I'm a full-time trainer at High Five, and I am joined by two very distinguished guests, Phil Brown and Chris Ortiz. Why don't you say four words about yourselves, gentlemen?
Four words? Oh.
That was three. You got one more left, Ortiz.
Happy.
Awesome. Phil?
I am here today.
I want mine to be happy to be here.
Wonderful. I'm happy to have you here. This is part four of our conversation.
Do that part again, because I heard a dog wagging his tail.
I know, that's the problem. I either have unstable internet or I have a dog. We are here today to talk about a television show that we all have enjoyed and find deep connections to our work in the facilitation and team development realm. The show is called The Bear. If you're hearing this episode and you have not heard the previous episodes on Vertical Playpen, you may find value in backing up and listening to them in order, although I don't plan to sort of build upon previous conversations necessarily.
We're all over the place.
We are. And so our listeners certainly have permission to be as well. In this particular episode, what I would like to do is look at the show and look at our work through a very particular lens. And that lens comes from a book written in 2017 by Chip and Dan Heath called The Power of Moments. This book, in my opinion, was very popular and well read several years ago. What I do with books like that is I don't know if this is going to work. I might need to go back to unstable internet land. You know, I used it a lot and I referred to it a lot. I even did a workshop at ACCT about it. And then I just sort of retired the book and put it on the shelf. And it's coming back up a lot because I think there was a lot of value. So let me summarize some key points in the book and then share the format that I suggest for this conversation. So Power of Moments is about a contrast to moments that we can experience in our lives that are powerful almost by accident. I have to move. Hold on. Can you pause the recording? Look at him. He's cute. He's a giant pain in the butt, though.
That was a chair. You showed us a chair.
You showed us a chair.
Well, yeah.
There he is.
I don't know.
It was like punctuating words like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah. Okay.
That was so great.
Power of Moments.
This book came off the shelf again recently because it's been chronically relevant. I just haven't been using it a lot in my current thinking. And so The Power of Moments distinguishes between moments that we can trip upon. So I had a transformative experience on the challenge course, for example, or I had a wonderful experience in a class in college. Those aren't moments that are particularly manufactured to be elevated or particularly wonderful, but they just happen to be. The Power of Moments is about how can we actually create those moments on purpose for people. And I have found value in the main concepts in the book in our work. And what I'd love to do today is briefly introduce the four concepts in the book in summary, and then invite us all to think about how those concepts show up in the show, either intentionally by a character or just as a viewer, we see those moments. And then the last piece I would invite us to do is sort of think about how those moments could apply to our work as facilitators in different environments. So I'm going to read some definitions of the four components of creating powerful moments, and they are elevation, pride, insight, and connection. And then what I'll do is share my own very brief example of how, like, where I can see parallels to the show and in our work. Elevation, a definition from the Heath brothers, is moments of elevation are experiences that rise above the routine. They make us feel engaged, joyful, surprised, motivated. To create them, we can boost sensory appeal, raise the stakes, and break the script. Research suggests that organizations dramatically underinvest in building peaks. Instead, we choose to fill potholes. So, I mean, I think the thing about this is that there's so many parallels that I can see. That's really which one. So I'm not suggesting like this is the best one. But in terms of creating those moments that rise above the routine, the piece that I thought about from the show is in the final episode when Sid's dad is being served and he says, "I don't actually drink alcohol." And they have a whole cart prepared for him of really special non-alcoholic drinks. And as a person who doesn't drink myself, I know how special it is when there's consideration into, yes, you can be a part of the festivities and join this. And you can see the look on his face of what it meant to him to have that pre-planned. He didn't have to make a special request. Somebody knew that and made that happen. And when I think about work, this is not a moment that I made happen, but I was a witness to. I had a workshop participant on day 4. It was her birthday. Her partner is someone who was not in the training, but I had met in previous training, and he texted me and asked if he could surprise the whole group by bringing a cake up to the challenge course. And so I was able to get the group into a very specific circle. He drove all the way up from New Haven, and we sang happy birthday. And it was just this incredible, beautiful moment that was manufactured by this person with my support that I'll never forget. The next one is pride. And again, this is in the language of the Heath brothers, not mine. Moments of pride commemorate people's achievements. We can use 3 strategies to deliver pride. 1, recognize others. A small investment of effort yields a huge reward for the recipient. 2, we can multiply meaningful milestones, meaning to reframe a long journey so that it features multiple finish lines. And 3, practice courage by preloading our responses in advance so that we're ready when the right moment comes. Those examples might not make a whole lot of sense because in the context of the book, there's long narratives about each one of those. The piece that I focused on with pride is this idea of taking a huge achievement and breaking it into smaller chunks. And the huge achievement that I see in the bear than the TV show is actually opening the restaurant at the end of season 2. And a little milestone that I think is so well broken down is when they pass the test with the balloon on the gas line. There's so much anticipation to that and what it meant for the energy of opening the restaurant that they were able to pass that gas test. I just watched that episode again recently. And I think a way that I've tried to apply this concept very simply in my work is to focus less on a final debrief, but have more sort of deep ceremonial and reflective practices throughout an experience and not just at the very end. So there can feel this sort of sense of milestones throughout an experience. The next one is insight. Moments of insight deliver realizations and transformations. To produce moments of insight for others, we can cause them to, quote, trip over the truth by revealing a clear insight that is compressed in time and discovered by the audience. To produce moments of self-insight, we must stretch, placing ourselves in situations that involve the risk of failure. An example that really comes to mind for me with insight is sort of where you trip over the truth is Tina. We talked about Tina in our last episode, how, you know, she goes from, at one point she says, "I think I might be good at this." And then there's all these moments where she's reinforced that she's good at this. She goes to get more training. She gets that knife that we talked about last time. It's not this huge before and after. It's a slow transformation with her. Where I think about that in our work is when we teach people how to belay for the first time, how different it is when they cannot actually go live until they have shown mastery. That they can do a really messy PBOS belay with a very, very expert, competent backup belayer. And being able to, that risk of failure, but with competent backup, is a much more effective teaching technique. The last one in this group of 4 concepts is connection. Moments of connection bond us together. Groups unite when they struggle together toward a meaningful goal. They often begin their work with a synchronized moment. In individual relationships, it's responsiveness that deepens our ties. A responsive interaction can bring people together very quickly. I think about that word synchronized, and I focused in the show on this very this detail that's so important in the show, which is their common use of language at the same time, how they, you know, corner, behind, heard, and that synchronization as the show continues gets crisper and more people are on board. And I think that's a real good example of the group being more and more connected in the kitchen. I struggle to think of an example in our work because it's all about connection, right? But the thing that I would share right now is my practice has changed in the last 5-10 years to starting new groups off with a challenge, not just icebreakers. So the acronym is EPIC. The Heath brothers don't love it when people call it EPIC, but that's the easy way to remember it, right? Elevation, pride, insight, connection. And I would love... We don't need to be as concrete as I was, like, here's the thing, here's how it applies to the show, here's how it applies to our work. But I would love to hear you. What do you gravitate toward in terms of those four concepts from the show and then bring it back to work?
The one that's jumping out at me right away is pride. The way you were describing pride, the element from the show, I think, comes, it makes sense. It's a restaurant setting, but it comes from the tasting of each other's creations. There's several moments with several characters in which that recognition from somebody else who they respect brings that source of pride and sort of elevates that. Tina, when she brings the mashed potatoes that she thinks she's been struggling with, and she brings them over, and they're like, and Cindy gives her these are great, gives her that positive reinforcement. And even Sid's working on that risotto dish that they kept struggling with. And I hope that comes back because they never really finalized that in season 2. So I'm hoping that shows up on the menu for season 3 when they open the restaurant. But there's an element of that there, as well as Marcus's donut is the other one that he's putting so much work and effort into, that the pride of that. And then that does come full circle, in which Carmi even tastes it off the floor after he realizes he'd been a jerk about the whole thing, and he's recognized, like, wow, this is actually really good, and then brings it up to Marcus later. Yeah, so I think there's an element of that there. I think it is an element. I was just talking with a client actually this morning about recognition. And so this is sort of where it crosses over for me, is organizationally, how do we recognize people? And everybody likes to be recognized differently. Step one of recognition is understanding how people want to be recognized, so that they can feel that pride in their work. Some people love to be recognized in public and share that openly with others, and others want it to be more quiet, and others are recognized with a respect of their time and effort and those sorts of things. There's just, everybody likes that differently. So I think step one of that creating pride element is to understand your team and what they need or want.
Yeah. And that reminds me, Chris, of how interwoven these four concepts are, because what you just said about getting to know how people want to be recognized is also about establishing connection, right? You really can't have that individual approach without those relationships.
The word pride, I know I'm not particularly stuck on it, but it's referenced as one of the 7 deadly sins, isn't it? Pride. I've met some people who have been very adamant that they don't like the word, you know, like if I've said, like, oh, I'm proud of my kids, like, oh, don't say you're proud. I personally don't really understand the holdup, but I think from maybe historical, maybe religious perspective, maybe pride is seen as a sin. In these regards, I think pride is tied in with purpose that we've referenced before, and is also tied into, like, value, like, how do we value each other and the work that I do? And I'm not sure if you took away the energy that I think Marcus has for, like, his donut and stuff, I think there's pride in his work. Without that, you get rid of the purpose. Like, I think that he needs to feel that recognition. It's the same for, like, I think Tina, like the gifting of the knife at the end. There's moments like an elevated experience there as well, because it's a totem of something. There's pride in the work. Like, you've hit this benchmark. You're able to... She made it to be a sous chef. She was able to wear the apron. She was able to receive the knife. And I don't see those as being a negative thing. But I'm intrigued by thoughts around the word pride, because I know it has negative connotation as well as positive.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't think about that. I mean, I you're absolutely right. And I when I see it in this context with the other three concepts, I don't think about it that way. Another piece that I just thought of in terms of within Pride in the Power of Moments, they talk about having sort of incremental milestones. And I gave the example of the gas line test. I also think that there's this whole episode where Sid and Carmi are cooking together, I think at Carmi's house or Carmi's apartment. And it's like each time they do it, he focuses on like a little bit more of this and a little bit more of this. And I assume that that's normal in a kitchen sort of menu creating process. But that idea of not just having, is it good or bad, but it's got, you know, there's very specific feedback. And I think that contributes to that sense of pride. What about this concept of insight, which, you know, the Heath brothers talk about having moments of insights deliver realizations and transformations. And to produce these, we need to help people trip over the truth, meaning sort of discover the insight themselves rather than be told the insight. Where do you see that happening in this show? I gave the example of Tina, who we've talked about quite a bit.
Again, this ties back the interconnectivity of these things with pride and purpose that you just talked about, Phil. I think some of this insight pieces in the show show up when somebody discovers their purpose. And season two was really that discovery of purpose. And we see it with multiple characters where they are tripping over the truth. They're figuring out what their purpose is and having that be the insight. And so for Richie, he went into that experience of him staging for another restaurant and not seeing any purpose and really not seeing the big picture. And he sort of stumbles upon it. And that for me actually, in that same moment. So while I saw that as him creating this, you know, having this moment revealed to him, this clear insight, it also created later on, I was connecting that to elevation. Because when they actually are doing the first family opening of the restaurant, and he has to step in to the expo role where he's basically in that role in charge of getting the food out of the kitchen to the tables and organizing essentially the production process. It's not necessarily what he went to that other restaurant to learn. He sort of picked it up as a peripheral of what and then in that moment recognized, he put two and two together almost. It's like, wait, I learned enough there. I can do this. Put me in, you know, this is my pace. And so I had this raised stakes, you know, kind of reading right off of the thing, broke the script a little bit. You know, this is sort of those elevated moments. With our groups, I think to tie it back to sort of the work that we're doing, when people can find that purpose, that connection to why they're doing the work that they're doing, and it doesn't feel like, how do we get people to understand why we're doing the work that we're doing isn't about just, you know, in this group that I was chatting with this morning, they put on events. And the purpose of those events is not to put on a good event. The purpose of those events was to create engagement and move those people towards action in some way. I love that they were thinking a little bit, like trying to get their folks to think a little bit about the purpose behind their work. And I think too many times we work with organizations where maybe the clear purpose of what people are doing isn't there for them. And so how do we help them shift that language and that narrative so that people can see, you know, again, this connection between discovering what your purpose is and then leveraging that to elevate an experience. Yeah, there's a lot of connection.
And do you think in the whole, and I know we've talked about Richie, but in terms of Richie tripping over the truth of his purpose in that Forks episode, do you, either of you think that Carmi sort of, that was the end game for Carmi? I think it was.
Yeah, I wrote down just now as we were talking, I think there's a difference between insight and then self-insight. So like just in terms of like how you gain that insight. And so I think that in Carmi's case, he sends him to a thing. I think knowing that maybe Richie would have this insight for himself, like he's going to find it. Because I think that he could have told him, your purpose is, the thing you're good at is, I believe you could do this. But rather, he just puts him into an experience. This is experiential education. Puts him into experience and lets him find the insight. I think about this is a technical reference, but like when I'm doing level two trainings, there are parts of that that are experientially focused. Like I'm going to give you a scenario. Your job is to figure out how to solve that scenario. Think about it with a lot of initiatives that we might lead. And the insight is like how they came up with the answer and figuring out the ways that doesn't work and figuring out the ways that do work for them. And that's different, individualized. But I think Kami set Richie this experience, right? Not, I don't think he anticipated where it might go. I think possibly he knew there was going to be some level of insight because he might have experienced himself, but he didn't want to prescribe that to Richie. He set the stage, and then Richie then had this self insight of this is what my purpose needs to be.
Yeah. And they even unveil that a little bit in that Richie feels like he was put there just to get him out of the way because he was causing trouble in the restaurant. And then when Richie has that conversation with chef of the restaurant that he's there helping, and she says, oh no, Carmi talked all about you and raved about you in this way and said you were really great with people, and sort of like, oh wait, he didn't just put me here. I think that's where some of it clicked for Richie in that setting.
Going back to the first concept of elevation, I gave the example of Sid's dad having that special drink cart and the workshop cake. One of the specific components of elevation that I am fascinated by is this concept of breaking the script. And the example, there's several examples in the book. It's a very easy, it's not a difficult like business book. It's a little bit more narrative. One of the examples that I love is of Joshy the giraffe in The Power of Moments. And the story of Joshy the giraffe is a family's on vacation in Florida at a Radisson hotel. And the five-year-old boy leaves behind his stuffed animal giraffe. And you can imagine, we're all parents, like that's chaotic when you get on the plane and your kid doesn't have their Joshy the giraffe. And the Radisson staff not only found the giraffe, but they made a picture book of Joshy having all these adventures at the resort, in the pool, at the snack bar, in the arcade, sleeping. And then they put that book in a package and Joshy the giraffe was returned to the family. And what does that mean for the kid? I mean, I love hearing about that story. It had nothing to do with me. But where do we see moments of the script being broken in a way that was positive, like in the Joshy case? And then where could we do that more in our facilitation? And I'll just say one more thing before you answer the question. When I go to a setting where it's very predictable, the keynote's going to get up, they're going to give a bunch of acknowledgements, they're going to say where the emergency exits are. And when that script is broken, how I'm automatically more engaged in whatever it is, even if it's a very compelling speaker. But when something just starts different than what I expect.
It might be the very last episode where things are not going well, Kami is trapped, things need to shift and change. And Richie ends up taking a different position instead of being front of house. He's now in charge of organizing the kitchen. And Fak has given a suit and the opportunity to go into the front of the house. I think there's a facial expression of like some level of fear and trepidation that like Fak has, but an extreme pride at his physical appearance, at his ability to be able to go in and take a different role. And I see that completely. Like, I don't think that necessarily he anticipated that he would get that opportunity as well, because that's not where every single person has a target end goal that we sort of anticipate happening. In fact, has always been like just helping out and doing maintenance and stuff. And there's no elevation of like, at some point you're going to lead to this. I think that feels, because he's a bit of the goofy character and I don't think people take him seriously. So I think that there's that moment of it feels like it's the script has been broken for his character. And in a way that like elevates him into a position where as well, he's now excited. He feels like he's got purpose and you could see that he's going to step up.
The other one I'm going to bring up is another sort of fringe character, which is Ibrahim, which I think sometimes that elevation, that breaking of the script is when someone expects something to go in a certain way and then there's a pivot that goes somewhere else. So Ibrahim very, very knowingly pulls himself out of the training that he's going into for all these chef skills and is kind of resistant to those things. And he assumes he will be let go. He'll have to move on to something else. And Tina, I think, facilitates this elevation or this sort of changing of the script for Ibrahim, which is that she negotiates how to bring him back into the fold of the restaurant. So like she sees the value there and knows that Carmi sees value in Ibrahim, and that's why he was investing in him. And behind the scenes, we don't necessarily see this, but negotiates, how do we get him back in? We can still open, we can still do sandwiches up through a to-go window that Ibrahim can spearhead, and he doesn't have to be attached to this high level dining maybe that he is not as interested in, whether he's intimidated by it or whatever that might be, I'm not sure, but that's not where his purpose is. That's not where his passion lies. And so he was being pushed down this road that he wasn't comfortable with. And then there's this opportunity that like would break the script of kind of bring you back in when you assumed you're out, kind of a thing.
Yeah, I agree. That was a surprise twist for Ibrahim, and I was happy to see it. And I'm curious how that's going to show up in the third season, which comes out in June. I don't know where this particular thing falls, I'm about to say, and I maybe you'll have a sense. And again, we're acknowledging that these four concepts are very well blended. I think that for me, the ultimate powerful moment born from tragedy was when Carmi, spoiler, opens the tomato sauce. Took me to go back and watch the whole thing again to see that the cans were labeled KBL. I didn't catch that at first. But there's this another concept that I think ties into power moments of setting something in motion where you're not going to see the result. And again, I acknowledge that that's tragic because Mikey took his own life in the show. That sense of taking care of others without sort of being at the center of the credit. And I think that goes back to pride. It also, you know, connects to connection. When I did a workshop on power of moments at ACCT several years ago, I ended the workshop by handing out blank thank you notes. And I challenged my participants to find somebody who has positively impacted them in the last 48 hours that they didn't know before, and to hand deliver that thank you note. And it was, I was so pleasantly surprised at how those stories came back to me of Lisa. I handed my hotel barista this thank you note, and she was so happy that she was crying. Like, just how, like, these ripple effects of pride that we can be several steps removed from. Where does that show up? I think it shows up most, I think, in your face with the discovery of the cash.
Did anyone else just randomly open up tins of tomatoes that they had at their house, tipping them out? My wife comes in, what's happening? Looking for money. I think it's important. I think that from a leadership perspective, team development perspective, training perspective that we do, I think we take for granted sometimes those small connections that we make with individuals, or where we make say something and it has a greater impact on them. I just want to read, I got a message from an attendee of workshops, but also a listener of the podcast. I've yet to write this person back, but this will serve as purposely me thanking them as well. But they say, hey, Phil, not sure if you remember me, and no worries if you don't, but I attended one of your level two trainings, blah, blah, blah. And then I came back for a CCM the year later. I came back after my first summer of using the skills and was excited at the potential of seeing you again. During one of the sessions, you joined for a bit and then said hello to me by my name. It was a simple interaction, but I never would have expected you to remember me, especially not my name. As a person who struggles to remember names, it meant a lot to me. Just to fit that person to send that, because I'd remember the name, I always reflect actually, Ortiz, that you were so really good at remembering people's names. And so I've tried to intentionally like spend the time to do that, because I do think it makes a big difference for people. And I think that we sometimes forget that stuff. So that's where my head was going when we were talking about powerful moments, that I think that we feel like they have to be elevated, but I don't necessarily think it has to be this higher level of elevation that we have to do this, because sometimes that can be exhausting to plan out, like, I'm going to do this big event and I'm going to make this a big deal. It's a simple case of just remembering someone's name and saying hello to them has made this person's day, which like I wouldn't have known that it would have happened.
Yeah, I just was leading a graduate seminar a couple weeks ago. They introduced me to the graduate students, like, hey, we have some videos for you as a way of introduction. It was like, what videos are they pulling off the internet? Like, what did I put out there into the public sphere that they're going to show as a way of introducing me? I had no idea. It was my former students talking about me as a teacher. And one of them actually brought up the name piece as well, and that he came into class in the second day. And I, one of the things that I promise to my students, and I get about 80 students a semester in two different classes, I promise them that by the fourth class, I will have memorized and know all of their names. And I have them, and I said, and I give myself a quiz. I have them all stand up, and we go through one by one, and I name them all. And anybody left standing at the end of that time, at the end of my own personal quiz there, it is a bonus point for all, everybody in the class. I have incentive to like learn their names because I know it's important. But I'm teaching a leadership and group dynamics class. I want them to understand the importance of making those connections and building those relationships with people. And be just the simple act of calling somebody by their name has always been something very important. To me, I've met lots of different people, and I know what that feels like when you've met somebody two or three times and they're like, what was your name again? And did I meet you before? Or they introduced themselves to me as though they never met me before. I was like, I've talked to you like four times. Like, and people have busy lives and it's not their forte. And that's that. But I think it's something personally as facilitators and people who are creating experiences for others, creating that connection in that way is, I think, a really valuable and important thing to do.
I heard this recently, and I still don't know exactly how I feel about it. I mean, I need to do some research. I was listening to another podcast, and it was talking about the sense of celebrity. But they were saying that celebrities either have charisma or they have charm. Charisma is innate ability that people have to be able to connect, whereas charm, I think, is a skill that you have to work on. And I think about that when we're talking about like names. Some people, you said, like some people might not have it. Like the ability to like, because they might not have this natural charisma, but I do think that there's something to like working on the charm part to be like, no, it's still, that takes work. But I think if you don't have either of those, if you're not charismatic or you're not charming, then it's very hard to get people to buy into the stuff that you might be selling. So I think that sometimes I have to work harder on the memorization because of a personality perception of a lack of charisma.
So I use different words, but same concept when I'm talking about leadership and teaching leadership is that what are some of the skills that show up on all these lists of great leaders? Charisma and sociability are the two words that I use, which is the charisma being that innate magnetism that people are drawn to you and like without effort, it's innate. And then sociability is something that we can teach and we can learn and we can practice. We can teach ourselves to be sociable. And it's just, and that's, I think, where if you have this feeling that I'm not necessarily that charismatic, but I can work on being a little more sociable, a little more approachable and relatable so that even though people aren't maybe magnetically drawn to me in the way when I walk in a room, I can present myself in a way that they are comfortable coming to me when they need me. And it was some of the things that we talked about in the early days of working with the Boston Bruins that the captains of that team needed to build their sociability because they had some very charismatic people on the team who had the potential to drive the culture in a direction that wasn't going to be healthy. And so their people who were wearing the letters on their sweaters needed to work on their sociability. And so that was it's an example I often bring up because you can sort of compensate for one with the other and you can learn and teach yourself that one. And so, we're kind of going down this rabbit hole of this other area.
It's such a great example. And I'll bring that back to the bear. And I think we should probably wrap up. In terms of charisma, I think there's not one character on the show that does not have charisma. Sociability, that's another question. And to go back to the fourth cornerstone of Power of Moments, connections, everybody in that cast, every character has a very specific place. There's nobody in the periphery and there's nobody who is alone, in my opinion. And I think that's really, you know, Tina's son is greeted warmly. Marcus's roommate greeted warmly. This, you know, the sister, Sugar, like I think there's so many examples of connections, but not all with sociability that I think is fascinating, Chris. I'd love to keep talking about that. But we've come to the end of our time. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I will now give you four more words.
I'm going to say elevate, pride, insight, connection. Good luck, Chris.
The power of moments.
that's a good one too. It feels like slightly better than mine. I want to say The Power of Moments.
And I'm going to say The Bear Season 3.
It's going to be epic.
It's going to be epic. And we have come full circle and the recording.
Thanks for listening to Vertical Playcast.
And then what about thanks for listening to High Fives Podcast?
Can you do it? Okay, try.
Thanks for giving us a good podcast, guys.